is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And I always put my team up to finding good stuff on the web, a cool video that no one saw or you should have seen but didn't. Whatever. Greatest and funniest column of the day. Just a cool new artist. And today, Jesse comes at me and says, you got to see this video. This thing's great. And it's from Bibb County, Georgia. And we broadcast to you from Oxford, Mississippi. So we love stories from small town America. And by the way, I was telling a friend the other day, and I grew up around New York. Listen to my accent. This does not exactly sound like a guy who grew up in Oxford, Mississippi. This one comes out of Bibb County, Georgia. And there's a program for troubled youth from ages 9 to 17 years old called Consider the Consequences. And it helps them stay in school, graduate, and begin a successful career. The teens experience what it's like to be in jail. They put on a jumpsuit, placed in a cell, and they meet with a judge. Well, Bibb County Superior Court Judge Verda Colvin brings a courtroom full of Consider the Consequences participants to tears, and all she does is tell them the truth.
Stop acting like you're trash and putting pictures of yourself on the internet. Stop being disrespectful to your parents. Care about your future. Be somebody. Anybody can be nothing. It doesn't take anything to be nothing. Be something. Do you understand what I'm saying? Care about yourselves. The fact that you're shedding tears means you want to be better and you want to do better. Do it. The only person stopping you is you. Do better than what you've been doing. Do you understand me? Do you understand me? I don't expect to ever see the three of you all back in my courtroom like this. One day I want you to come tell me. Judge Colvin, when I got gray in my hair, because I can't even color it anymore because it's so much gray, I want you to come tell me. Judge Colvin, I graduated from college. You might not remember me, but back in 2016, you said something to me to make a difference. I am sick and tired of seeing people who look like you and I come in my courtroom and I have to sentence them to prison. And then you hear them fussing on TV about African Americans being in the prison system. Well, guess what? If you don't do what it takes to go there, you won't be a part of it. You already know the game. If you know they come in your community more than they do in other communities, then guess what? You've got a heads up. So that means you've got to do what's right, right? Don't let me see you here again. Young man, let me tell you something. I raised a young man as a single parent by myself. I know all the stuff that comes up for you all. I know it all. Been there, done that. Because my son, Mr. Cool, graduated Mr. whatever his high school. You know how they have kings and queens. He's the king of the high school. So you can imagine, I've gone through every experience. Because if you're popular enough to be voted Mr. He went about and says, Mr. Mountain Sales, then you know everybody. I'm going to tell you what I told him. Son, I know you cool and all that. I get it. I know that. I know you just the man. But what I'm going to tell you, you know I'm a little crazy. So don't come up in this house with any mess. So when folks come at you with dope, this gang stuff, I'm going to tell you what I told him. Pump it. Man, you know my mom crazy. I got to go. I just can't, you know, she crazy. And his friends knew I was, you know, I don't mind going there. And I don't know if your moms are like me. I don't know if they tell y'all this is the real deal, buddy. You better get it together. But I'm telling you, if your moms don't say that, consider me your surrogate mom. Don't you come up in here. I'm sick of seeing young men who look like you all, and more prevalent young men who look like you, white and black all together, coming in this court system, going to jail for something stupid. Get yourselves together. Stop this. Why would you want to be another statistic? Do you want to be another African-American male in a jail cell? Do any of you all want? Is that what you want for your lives? Come on. Somebody raping you in the middle of the night, and there's nothing you can do but just lay there. Because guess what? Everybody got to get their turn. So it's your turn, because you're the new meat on the block. That's the reality. And these officers standing here can tell you that even happens locally. I hadn't even asked them, but I know it does. That happens locally in jail. So imagine if you go down the road. Jackson has something for you. That's where you have to go in and do the intake when you go down the road. They've got something for you. And guess what? As big and bad as you all think you can, they got something for you. Believe you me, Those inmates have something for you. So you need to get some gold. Now, you didn't raise your hand, young man, about having a gold. You've got to get a gold. Counter, we got to get. We can't have a counter. We got to get one. Because I'm telling you, if you don't make a goal for yourself, society's going to make one of these two options a goal. And I'm serious. I'm not telling you all anything different that I didn't tell my son. But you have to make a decision that you're going to do something different. And don't use your family situation as an excuse. You hear me? Don't use that as an excuse. I don't know what's going on in your lives. I don't know where you live, but don't use it as an excuse. Anything either of you all are going through, somebody else went through it who's successful now. My mom made below the poverty level. She was a single mom, and my dad didn't help a whole lot. He did the bare minimum. But I didn't use that as a reason why I couldn't go to college. Guess what? If your parents don't have money, you can go to college almost free. That's the beauty of it. If you don't want to go to college, get a skill, but you've got to do something. I didn't allow my son to use the fact that his father wasn't in the house with us as an excuse. I didn't allow that, because what I told him is you have everything you need, because if you needed something else, you have it. And that's what you all got to know. Everything you need, you have. Young man, do you hear me? Everything you need, and look at you, got a polo shirt on and sitting here because you messed up like that. Somebody cared enough about you to get that shirt. How old are you? And all this alternative school mess, this is ridiculous. See, you're already labeling yourself. When you go to alternative school, that's on your record. People see that. But even if you got to be there, change the course. Start being different. So they can have to attach something different to your name. Anybody can do nothing. Why would you want to do nothing? Anybody can do and be nothing.
And that's Judge Verda Colvin. We'll pop that on our website, OurAmericanNetwork.org. Get yourselves together, she chided these boys and girls. Why do you want to be another statistic? Is that what you want with your lives? We need more voices like Judge Verda Colvin. White, black, Hispanic, we all need this. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Thanks, Jesse, for digging this up. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Muddy Waters, and that's The Last Waltz, directed by Martin Scorsese, Dr. John, Eric Clapton, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, Ronnie Hawkins, but you knew the man who stole the show was Muddy Waters. And Jesse's a big, my boy Jesse here is a big blues fan, and we've got a piece on Muddy Waters. He was an American blues musician who is often cited as the father of modern Chicago blues. Muddy grew up on Stovall Plantation near Clarksdale, Mississippi, just about an hour from Oxford, where we broadcast from. And we bring you, on this day, his birth, his story.
Muddy Waters was born McKinley Morganfield on April 4th, 1915, in Rolling Fork, Mississippi, a rural town on the Mississippi River. He was given the moniker Muddy Waters because he played in the swampy puddles of the Mississippi River as a boy. When Waters was just 3 years old, his mother, Bertha Jones, died, and he was subsequently sent to Clarksdale to live with his grandmother, Delia Jones. Waters began to play the harmonica around the age of five and became quite good. He received his first guitar at the age of 17 and taught himself to play by listening to recordings of Mississippi blues legends like Charlie Patton.
First with the harmonica, as I said, what the kids begin to the Waters from the harmonica I like. And I picked up the guitar after listening to a great old guy by the name of Son House. And when I became 17 years old, you heard of Sad Night Fish Fries, but we call them, used to have supper to go to the Juke House or whatever. They had different guys come in from all over, like playing these at these parties. Guys like Charlie Patton and the Mississippi Sheiks and Son House, all the kind of people that I learned with.
Although Waters spent countless hours working as a sharecropper at a cotton plantation, he found time to entertain folks around the town with his music.
It wasn't a going easy thing because we was doing, cause like sharecropping I raised up like a sharecropper, you know, worked on the plantation where I raised cotton and corn and beans and all that jive. And it wasn't exactly the slavery time, but it wasn't, there was no really good time, you know. I mean, we had a good time. I learned all of my music through that spirit. So it was wonderful for me to, I guess, to live that, and then I knew what I was trying to learn.
In 1941, he joined the Silas Green Tent Show and began to travel.
A lot of it came right out the field where I learned and doing my work on the plantation, because I grew up to be able to drive tractors and trucks. And before I left, I was in my late 20s when I left Mississippi.
As he began to gain recognition, his ambition grew.
Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of 5, my mother said I was gonna be the greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, way past 21. You got to believe me, woman, I have lots of fun. I'm a man.
Then, after Alan Lomax and John Work, who were archivists and researchers for the Library of Congress Field Recordings Project, caught wind of Waters' unique style, they sought him out to make this recording.
I'm getting late over the evening, child, I feel like blowing my horn. I woke up this morning and find my little baby gone. Late over in the evening, man, I feel like blowing my horn. Well, I woke up this morning, baby, find my little baby gone.
In 1943, Muddy Waters finally picked up and headed to Chicago, Illinois, where music was shaping a generation. The following year, his uncle gave him an electric guitar. It was with this guitar that he was able to develop the legendary style that transformed the rustic blues of the Mississippi with the urban vibe of the big city. Working at a paper mill by day, Waters was sweeping the blues scene by night. By 1946, he had grown so popular that he'd begun making recordings for big record companies such as RCA, Columbia, and Aristocrat. It wasn't until 1950, when Aristocrat became Chess Records, that Waters' career really began to take off.
Well, my mother told my father.
Rolling Stone, one of his singles, became so popular that it went on to influence the name of the major music magazine, as well as one of the most famous rock bands to date, the Rolling Stones.
He's gonna be a Rolling Stone. Sure enough, be the Rolling Stone. Sure enough, be the Rolling Stone. Well, he's a...
By 1951, Muddy Waters had established a full band with his Otis Spann on piano, Little Walter on harmonica, Jimmy Rogers on second guitar, and Elgin Evans on drums. The band's recordings were increasingly popular in New Orleans, Chicago, and the Delta region in the United States. But it wasn't until 1958, when the group brought their electric blues sound to England, that Muddy Waters became an international star. After the English tour, Muddy Waters' fan base expanded and began to catch the attention of the rock and roll community. His performance at the 1960 Newport Jazz Festival was a particularly pivotal point in his career, as it caught the attention of a new fan base. Waters was able to adapt the changing times and his electric blues sound to fit in well with the Love Generation.
And I knew, now the war going on, trouble in the east, and the weapon town on. Some folk talk peace, but it won't last. The world is turning much too fast. Son got mad, shot Papa down. New troublemaker just coming down. Where you gonna run to, and where you gonna hide? Where you gonna run, where you gonna hide?
Waters continued to record with rock musicians throughout the 1960s and 70s and won his first Grammy Award in 1971 from the album They Call Me Muddy Waters. After his 30-year run with Chess Records, he went his separate way in 1975, suing the record company for royalties after his final release with them, Muddy Waters' Woodstock album. Waters signed on with Blue Sky label after the split. He then captivated audiences with his appearance in the band's farewell performance, known as The Last Waltz, an exceptionally star-studded affair that was released as a film by Martin Scorsese in 1978.
I'm a full-grown man. I'm a natural born lover's man. Man, I'm a rolling stone. Man, child, I'm a hoochie.
By the end of his lifetime, Muddy Waters had garnered 6 Grammys as well as countless other honors. He died after suffering a heart attack on April 30th, 1983, in Downers Grove, Illinois. Since his death, Muddy Waters' contribution to the music world has continued to gain recognition. In 1987, Waters was posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 5 years later, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences awarded the musician a Lifetime Achievement Grammy Award. Some of the most recognizable names in music have named Muddy Waters as their single greatest influence, including Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, and Johnny Winter. Here's Eric Clapton.
Most of the players that came to Chicago that were really vital came from what they call the Mississippi Delta, the Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. They played in bands and they played in clubs. They had actually a way to become sophisticated, I think, and they had competition. The guys would come up and they'd go and visit Muddy in his club and they'd see how sharp he was and the kind of suits he was wearing and the kind of money he was getting, and they'd have to revise their act and it would speed up the process and bring out the best, the absolute best in everybody. I would have been 18 or 19, and I got a call from this guy, Mike Vernon. He said, there's a great opportunity for you to come and play with Muddy and Otis. I tried my best to be cool, but I was just in bits. All I can remember is them dancing. I remember them because we all did it, it was over in about an hour. It was so fast. And these guys had suits on that were like silver silk, big suits. And that when they were listening to the playback, they danced and they held their trousers up. So that, you know, they were big trousers, and they would do these kind of fancy foot steps, holding their trousers up like skirts, you know. And it was just breathtaking. He meant a great deal to me, and his music still does, probably more than anybody else's. It was the first, really, that got to me, and it still is the most important music in my life today, is the music of Muddy Waters.
Though Muddy Waters' life lasted from April 4th, 1915 to April 30th, 1983, passing away at the age of 70, his music influenced the blues and rock world for an eternity. For Our American Stories, I'm Jesse Edwards.
Great job on that, Jesse. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of McKinley Morganfield, a.k.a. Muddy Waters. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear this and all the other things that we do. Before I pee. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And from time to time, we like to talk about public policy and where it hits the pavement, how it affects you and I, how it affects all of us. And we do our show from Oxford, Mississippi, a small town in northern Mississippi. I have family and roots here on my wife's side, and we live all over the state. And there are many parts of this state, like many parts of America, that are deeply rural. Not everybody in this country lives in a big city or in a suburb of a big city. And we like to cover the stories that affect all of America, from fishing towns, straight through small rural towns, as well as big cities. We don't discriminate. And a story came across our desk that we just had to bring you. And it's the story of, well, David versus Goliath is all I can say. And it's citizens challenging their own government. And we love telling the stories, especially when they win, when they do challenge their government. And Dr. Carol Landrum is the only doctor in the struggling town of Edwards, Mississippi, a town of 1,034 residents. And is such a David who did win a battle with the help of Christina Sandifer, the executive vice president at the Goldwater Institute. And they are both on the line with us now. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. Dr. Landrum, we wanted to start with you. Before we get to the story, we want to take a dive into the story behind the story. Tell us about Dr. Landrum before we get into the actual details of your battle. Tell us a bit about your childhood and what inspired you to become a doctor in the first place, sir.
Well, I grew up in a small farm, 80 acres or so, and we grew cotton. We had about eight acres of cotton, which was our cash crop, and corn and hay and a few cattle. And I went to a country school called Taylorsville, Mississippi. First, I went to a little country school out in the close to where we lived, and it was just a four-room building, and then went on to high school at Taylorsville, Mississippi. I was always interested in medicine, but I never thought I'd become a doctor. I hadn't entertained that. I hadn't thought of that much. I was inspired by the doctor, small-town doctor, who cared for us and our family. He was always happy. We never were in a position to pay him cash. That didn't bother him. He was an inspiration, and I got in high school, and there was one of the professors in vocational agriculture. I don't know why, but he took a special interest in me, and he tutored me and mentored me. I got drafted into the Navy right out of high school. World War II was going, and then sent to a ship, a destroyer escort, and we went to the South Pacific. And in the ship's library, there was a book called Burma Surgeon, and I read it, and the inspiration there was decision making. That it was about a mission hospital on the Irrawaddy River in Burma, and about the events that transpired there. I decided on medicine when I got out of the Navy. I got my letter of admission to medical school, and I'd gone through it straight through in college because I didn't have much, a lot of money, just a little money. And I estimated I'd lost time, and it'd be the least expensive way to go straight through. When I graduated from medical school, the Korean War was gone, and they had a doctor's draft, and previous service didn't count unless it was a doctor. So I was facing a draft again, so I just volunteered and went on into the Air Force and was a doctor in the Air Force for 2 years, and I finished the term in the Air Force and then started private practice in Biloxi, Mississippi. I practiced there for about 5 years. And I was always interested in cancer research because my father died of cancer. And when he was ill, I came home from school and they were having a hard time. And I asked him if he wanted me to drop out of school and help. And he said, no, go back to school. I cried all the way. And in the back of my mind, I said, someday I'll figure it out. I had a girlfriend, and she said she wanted to live in a small town. So I moved upstate, and 3 months later, she left to be Miss America and left me stranded. So that's how I ended up in a small town in Mississippi. That was fine with me because I always dreamed of having a little clinic on Main Street like our hometown doctor had, and treating the people who had dealt with the cattle and so forth and had the type of diseases that farmers would have. And that's how I came about being in Edwards. I've been there ever since, so that kind of sums it all up.
Well, that's That's a quite a story, sir. And you're quoted in the Washington Post saying you'd always had a heart for the poor. And the average income in Edwards is $12,308 a year. And you had also said that you'd pictured yourself doing the same as that doctor had done for you as a boy, that same thing, that one of those people that obviously had inspired you. It says here that the most you charged a patient was $45 a visit. And the one of the core things I thought really struck me was that you said you saw firsthand what happens to families in your community, which is one of the poorest in a poor state, when the breadwinner cannot go to work because he or she is sick. You say the consequences are just so dire. It's homelessness, actually, and worse. And talk about that community of yours before we then get into what happened and why there was a challenge between you and a showdown between you and your own government. Talk about that town where you were a doctor and the real needs of rural folks in this country and the needs you were attending to, sir.
A lot of them are extremely poor. When I first went there, I saw a family who lived in a shed beside a hog barn with a dirt floor. Now that's an extreme example. Mm-hmm. And I saw a family that lived on a riverbank in a tent and fished for a livelihood. But most of them just live from payday to payday and pay the big bills. The even emergency room bills are beyond them. If they could pay, okay. But if they couldn't pay, not make a big issue of it. That was the situation.
Right. So you've been practicing now for over 50 years. You decided you couldn't stay in your office any longer because of the danger around that office. There were guns. There was violence. It was a place where people were afraid to go to. You were afraid to go to. And so you started doing something that you felt compelled to do, that you felt was the only way for you to serve the needs of your people and the community, and that was to deliver medicine out of your car and to go from place to place and bring, in the end, your practice to the people's homes, your car being your office.
I knew there were limitations, and they did too, so I tried to stay within bounds as far as what I did, and if I could handle it competently, I would, and if I thought I couldn't, I'd refer them on. I usually checked on them. I'd call them and check on them, see if they were responding. And every patient I saw, I'd say, if you're not better each day, give me a call. And that's the way that operated.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we come back. We've heard from Dr. Carol Landrum and his story in Edwards, Mississippi. And next, we'll be joined by Christina Sandifer, the Executive Vice President at the Goldwater Institute, as this small, small town doctor, and I'm talking small, small town doctor, comes into conflict with the state regulators in the state of Mississippi. This is Lee Habib again. This is Our American Stories. More with this story right after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're joined now by Christina Sandifer, the Executive Vice President at the Goldwater Institute. And Christina, it turns out that Dr. Landrum's doing this service. He's doing it out of his car. And pretty soon, the Mississippi State Board of Medical Licensure was in the mix. How did you find out about this case, Christina? And then what brought you and attracted the Goldwater Institute to defend Dr. Landrum against the state medical board?
Well, we first heard of Dr. Landrum's case in a news article, actually. It was in a Mississippi paper, and it struck me as really ridiculous that an administrative board would go after somebody who was helping the community. You know, Dr. Landrum is a true American hero. As you heard, he served his country in World War II and in the Korean War, and now he serves his community as their only doctor. As you mentioned, sometimes traveling up to 50 miles to see patients who otherwise wouldn't get medical care, and yet his own government treated him as an outlaw. I had read that an investigator with a badge came to meet Dr. Landrum and threatened him with a lot of vague threats. It told him that, you know, he shouldn't be operating a business out of his car, that he shouldn't be making house calls, and asked Dr. Landrum on the spot to surrender his license, which, of course, could have been an actual death sentence for the community of Edwards and for Dr. Landrum's patients. So, you know, at the Goldwater Institute, we work in states nationwide in order to protect liberties and defend people's constitutional rights. And so this story struck me as one that we ought to investigate. It's difficult a lot of times when these things happen in small communities because governments are very powerful and individuals, both patients and doctors, really don't have that the type of power to fight back against bureaucratic overreach. And that's why organizations like ours exist. So I hopped on the next plane, and Dr. Landrum was kind enough to take a few minutes out of his schedule treating patients to meet with me, and we met, and I heard stories from all of his patients about how desperate they were to keep him operating, and well, we told him that you know, that we would provide whatever assistance he needed in figuring out what to do about this situation. At that time, the medical board still wouldn't really, they weren't really clear on what the issue was. They just didn't seem to like the way that Dr. Landrum practiced.
Right.
And so we came down to help him with that.
You know, I was struck, by the way, you know, I love watching old movies with my family, and I want to teach my little girl that just because she wasn't born doesn't mean there's not a movie worth seeing. And we're watching some of the old Clark Gable movies, the old Humphrey Bogart movies. I mean, and routinely, you will see a doctor. We just, East of Eden, there's a great scene where the dad's dying and James Dean's trying to reconvene. And the family doctor comes up with that little black bag, and he's attending to the needs of a family out of that bag. That's it. And so was there actually a legal argument here, Christina, by the board in the end? And what was your counter argument back? And what happened next? Tell us about how this David and Goliath story ends.
Well, you bring up, you know, an excellent point. This making house calls might not be something that we hear about a lot in big cities where people have relatively easy access to medicine, but it's still a big deal in rural areas, and it certainly has been, you know, a common practice in the history of this country. Yet here the board just didn't seem to like it, and unfortunately, you know, the board's supposed to have the best interests of the patients in mind, but it's not in the best interests of the patients to deprive them of their only doctor, and that's really what they were doing. I think this is part of a broader problem, really, with the rise of unaccountable agencies. We have government now in control of every area of our lives, and it's not so much about keeping people safe, but it's really turned into a permission culture, right? It's instead of being free to practice medicine or practice your business unless you do something wrong, instead you're guilty until proven innocent, and you have to prove to the government that the way you do things, even if it's a little bit unorthodox, is something that you should be allowed to do. And that's what happened in Dr. Landrum's situation. When we you know, when we looked into the situation, the board was really going after Dr. Landrum's license. They weren't giving any good reasons, just vague reasons about how they didn't like the mobile practice. They thought that that would be a problem for record keeping. And they wanted, if Dr. Landrum didn't surrender his license, they wanted to put him through this big administrative hearing, you know, where he might not have even had a lawyer. And the problem with administrative hearings is that, you know, we all think about court, right? When you're accused of a crime, you get a lawyer, you go to court, you have due process, you get to be heard, there's a judge. There are rules of evidence, which sound like little minute details, but are really, really important because they protect your rights. In this situation, Dr. Landrum was getting none of that. He wasn't even getting a clear answer from the board as to what the problem was. And so if he hadn't had the help of the media or the help of attorneys to come in and protect his practice, I don't know where his patients would have stood today. So we went to the medical board. We had a formal meeting with them and were able to work this out, which I was very pleased that we were able to do that. Basically, the medical board could not give us very good reasons. I think they would not have had a legal leg to stand on as to why they wanted Dr. Landrum to give up his license at the meeting. They eventually just said, well, you know, we would like to know where he keeps his records just so that we're sure that the medical records are kept appropriately, which, of course, Dr. Landrum was perfectly fine with. He keeps records and will continue to do so. And at the end of the day, Dr. Landrum was returned to what he does best and what his patients needed most, practicing medicine. But I'll tell you, if it had not gone that way, he could have been put through a process that would have just been a black hole of bureaucratic red tape. And in the meantime, his patients would have had no doctor. This kind of thing happens across the country all the time. We only hear about government overreach and abuse when it reaches the big cities or when it happens to be on a major news network or when people are wealthy enough to have attorneys that can come in and defend them. But when governments just don't like the way that somebody does business, it's not the way that, you know, the medical board sees brick and mortar doctors as being the way of the future. And if they don't like somebody that deviates from that practice and they go after them, it's very difficult to stand up to that, even if there's no good legal reason for doing so.
Well, we appreciate the fine work that you do, Christina, over at the Goldwater Institute. And these are like essential property rights in the end. They're basic. These are basic liberties that the government really has no right to deprive us of. And again, you bring up that great point that we're guilty until proven innocent with these administrative bureaucracies. And it's very difficult for the little guy to fight back. Dr. Landrum, I wanted to ask you one last question. Why are you still practicing at 88 years old? Most folks at 88, well, they just want to lay back in the rocker, have a good iced tea here in the heat in Mississippi, and just lay low. Talk about why you just don't want to give up this medical practice of yours.
Well, I never entertained the thought of retiring. I enjoy keeping up with what's happening in medicine, the new viral agents that are coming along, and I've been working on this cancer thing, and it spilled over into infectious diseases, and I just never lost interest in keeping up with what's going on in the medicine field. I subscribe to one publication. Their topic is infectious diseases, and they write on top of these new viral agents and the things that it causes, potentially cause pandemics or epidemics and that type of thing in different parts of the world. And I just enjoy keeping up with it and figuring out the problems, and I enjoy, I really enjoy being with people, meeting people. I like people. And I just never entertained the thought of not doing that. I'm not one who can sit and watch TV and push a lawnmower and that type of thing.
Well, Dr. Landrum, thank you for all you do for the people of Edwards, Mississippi. And Christina Sandifer, well, I don't know what to say, but, you know, half of us who've ever gone to a law school, I think, would have wanted to do with their legal degree what you're doing for Dr. Landrum and so many other folks. Thanks so much for all the work you all do over at the Goldwater Institute.
Well, thanks so much for your support and for having us on.
You bet. Thanks, both of you. And look forward to many more.
Thank you.
Bless you. And Christina,
you
bet. Christina, keep sending us the stories of the work you're doing. We want to continue to follow the great work of the Goldwater Institute.
Will do. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Thank you a lot, sir.
Thank you all. This is Lee Habib, and this is the kind of story you'll only hear on Our American Stories. And what a good David and Goliath story. If you've got stories like this in your neck of the woods, share them with us. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and post your story on our website, or give us a call at 877-655-6755. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the evening, the life of Martin Luther King. In this hour, we wanted to talk about the way the media makes over Martin. And this comes from a column that dropped today in National Review, and that I had written in 2013, and every year NRO publishes this. It's one of only a few columns, actually, that they do that with. So I'm pretty honored. And here's how it begins. And you'll be hearing a lot from Martin, because I quote him intensely and extensively and compare and contrast his speeches with those of Malcolm X. Listen carefully to all the celebrations of Martin Luther King this week. Listen very carefully. There is one aspect of King's life that you won't hear much about, no matter how hard you try. His devotion to his faith, his devotion to his God, his devotion to Jesus Christ. Listen carefully and you'll hear endless mentions of Dr. Martin Luther King, but little if any mention of the Reverend Martin Luther King. Listen carefully to all of the video and audio clips and you'll hear some of the greatest rhetoric and some of the most passionate speeches of the 20th century. The sound bites and clips will stir your soul, but you won't hear the references to God that so often filled his speeches, nor will you hear references to the book that inspired him, the Bible. You won't hear references to God because the secular media dislikes the Bible so much and public affirmations of a belief in Christ that they do everything in their power to redact them. The Reverend Martin Luther King loved the Bible so much that he got an undergraduate degree in Bible studies. At modern universities, they call it a divinity degree. His PhD was in theology. To King, the Bible wasn't some strange old book that didn't have relevance in modern times. It was God's Word. It was a book that was and always will be relevant because it expresses eternal principles and eternal truths. And you know how much the media hates talking about ideas like eternity or principle or that really awful word, truth. In a version of his famous A Knock at Midnight speech, which you are unlikely to hear in the media this week, you're going to hear it here. King started with a quote from one of his great speeches from Luke chapter 11, verses 5 and 6.
And he said unto them, which of you shall have a friend and shall go unto him at midnight and say unto him, friend, lend me 3 loaves. For a friend of mine in his journey is come to me, and I have nothing to set before him.
Listen to his tenor and tone. This sounds more like a sermon you'd get on a Sunday. And it was. Why start a speech about the problems of the 20th century with a parable from an ancient text? Well, Reverend King explains why.
Now, this is a parable dealing with the power of persistent prayer. And as I look at this parable, I see within it a basic outline and a basic guide in dealing with many of the problems that we confront in our nation and in the world today, and the role of the church. Now, the first thing that we notice in this parable is that it is midnight. It is also midnight in our world today. And we are experiencing a darkness so deep that we can hardly see which way to turn. It's midnight.
He goes on then in this speech to talk about the limits of psychology to help us in this struggle at midnight.
People are more worried, more frustrated, more bewildered today than at any period of human history. What are the popular books, the bestsellers in religion today? They are books entitled Peace of Mind, Peace of Soul. And who are the popular preachers? They are so often preachers who would preach nice little soothing sermons on how to be happy, how to relax, how to keep your blood pressure down. And so we have retranslated the gospel to read, "Go ye into all the world and keep your blood pressure down, and lo, I will make you a well-adjusted personality." All of this is indicative of the fact that it is midnight in the psychological order.
It is midnight in the psychological order, and King believes there's only one thing that can cure that, and that's a spiritual cure for those things that beleaguer us in the material world. And this was King's essence. And this is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, you're going to hear from King, more from this great speech and another. You'll also hear from a young Malcolm X, because these two great men were competing for the soul of the nation, one a Christian voice of tolerance and love, and the other a radical Islamic voice of hate and anger, and in the end, war. This is Lee Habib and more with the story of the Reverend Martin Luther King, here on Our American Stories.
I'm pressing on. Yeah, I'm pressing on. And I'm pressing on.
At the end of a storm is a golden sky and the sweet silver song of a lark. Walk on
This is Lee Habib. Elvis' love of gospel. Well, watch the documentary on it. Comes on PBS now and then. After his concerts, he'd go downstairs with his guys go around a piano and play, as he called it, the music he really loved. By the way, he always performed it in public, too. And we're celebrating the life of Dr. Martin Luther King and the universal appeal of his Christian faith. Well, we were just commenting during the break that, my goodness, it was so beautiful and so, so inspiring that young white Jewish kids from the North marched down in the South with him, and some, it cost them their lives. But Martin's faith inspired that kind of courage in people, even people who didn't believe as he believed. And for the hour, we're going to talk about how the media just doesn't bring so much of Reverend King's faith to light, and that's what we're doing here, because, my goodness, it animated everything he did. And so we're covering his famous Knock at Midnight speech, which everyone should listen to and hear. It's one of the great sermons, I think, of all time, and one of the great pieces of theological thinking. So toward the middle of the speech, we had just heard King talk about the limits of psychology. And this is where God has to come in. King then goes on to condemn moral relativism.
Midnight is a time when all moral values lose their distinctiveness. And so in our world today, for so many people, there's nothing absolutely right, nothing absolutely wrong. Nobody is concerned about obeying the Ten Commandments in so many instances. They are not important. Everybody is busy trying to obey the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. This tragic moral laxity, this tendency to be caught up in the chains of conformity, is destroying the soul of our nation.
So why don't the media showcase this dimension of King, you might be wondering? Or this clip? We found it. They can't? Well, after all, his commitment to equality and his commitment to social justice were driven by the same spirit, the Holy Spirit. Why don't we see or hear the video clips of his religious speeches, even though they are easy to find, thanks to YouTube? And that's where we found this one. You don't think producers at ABC, CBS, and NBC News could find this? We know why. Because secular liberals love to secularize the sacred. They love to remove King's source of inspiration, his love for God, and reduce it to something more earthly. Such is his desire for social justice. But whose justice is the question? His own, the government's, the Supreme Court's? No. Always it was God's. But don't trust me on this one. In what may be the most beautiful document written in the 20th century, Letter from a Birmingham Jail, King identified his source of inspiration. And we had somebody do a dramatic reading of this, because I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of writing in the 20th century. Pick it up and read it sometime. But take a listen to our guy do a reading from this remarkable pamphlet.
We will win our freedom, because the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of God are embodied in our echoing demands.
King was in jail when he wrote that, because he believed that the law of man had created segregation, and that law was unjust. In jail, he had addressed why, as a man of God, he felt compelled to break the law to change it.
How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law.
So here was King imposing his view of morality through his faith on to the legislative body. Today you would hear never-ending cries of separation of church and state. What a stupid and silly and narrow version of what that all means. King spoke with great clarity in this essay. He was fearless, he was faithful, and that's what made him so dangerous, not only to segregationists, but to racists everywhere. And that's why, by the way, totalitarians always get rid of God first. King also invoked God's mercy in his speeches, and nonviolence was always his methodology. Not everyone agreed, though, with King's approach back in the early 1960s. a young Muslim named Malcolm X had a different vision for black America. Malcolm X was a member of the Nation of Islam and a follower of its leader, Elijah Muhammad. Like King, Malcolm X was a brilliant orator, but he had little tolerance for King's Christian emphasis of nonviolence, especially the whole part about loving our enemies and the whole part about loving the same white people who had mistreated so many black people in our country. Indeed, Malcolm X thought King was weak and his message feeble. On more than one occasion, he publicly accused King of being an Uncle Tom, a tool of the white establishment. In Malcolm X's message to the grassroots in Detroit in 1963, he described the role of this Uncle Tom.
The same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Toms, 20th century Uncle Toms, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful in nonviolence. That's Tom making you nonviolent.
And Tom was Reverend King. This was a direct attack. Malcolm X wasn't just attacking King, though. He was mocking him. In the same Detroit speech, he decried King's Christian nonviolence.
Our revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way. And you sitting around here like a knot on the wall saying I'm going to love these folks no matter how much they hate me. No, you need a revolution.
Two competing visions, folks. One, Christian love. Another, well, let's face it. This was the Nation of Islam's hate creed. Malcolm X thought all of the hymns, all of the prayers, all the hand-holding, all that churchiness, it was just plain silly.
Who ever heard of a revolution where they lock arms singing, we shall overcome? Just tell me you don't do that in a revolution. You don't do any singing, you're too busy swinging.
Leadership matters, folks. Philosophy matters. So imagine being a young black man in the 1960s and hearing these two appeals. This was the fight. By the way, no one's doing this story today here on Martin Luther King's Day. Nobody's doing this. So thanks for listening. Thanks to my great team for pulling this all together. Luckily for America, King's Christian impulse prevailed. Now, you won't hear any of this on TV or the radio anytime today or this week. The media will simply ignore all this yucky, messy God talk and all the icky Jesus talk. And you won't hear the secular left invoke the separation of church and state when it comes to King's legacy. You will never hear the secular left complain that King used the power of his pulpit and the power of his faith to change the culture and indeed change the law. When many of us wonder as we approach the national holiday in his honor is this, what would King have to say about our current problems? What would he have to say about fatherlessness in the African-American community? Heck, in our whole country. What would he have to say about crime, drug abuse, the culture? What would he have to say about abortion? These are things to think about. And again, you heard what he was up against. It wasn't just the white folks going after him and the segregationists. It was black folks competing for the soul of African Americans across this country, Malcolm X in particular. We know what he would have said about the economy, by the way. King was a social justice liberal, and he cared passionately about the poor. When we come back, we're going to spend a little time talking about that and what Christians are implored to do by God with their money. And the question is, do we give it to the government to redistribute? Or do we give it ourselves? Give it to our churches and the churches redistribute that money? A big question, a big philosophical question we Christians grapple with every day. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. For the hour, Martin Luther King, the secularization of the sacred. And that's Reverend King. We will not call him Dr. King this hour.
saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
This is Lee Habib. And you're listening to Johnny Cash singing the most recorded song in world history. I love this song when I was an atheist, and I love this song as a Christian, because the message is just so damn stirring and beautiful. We're talking about the life of Martin Luther King, and that's Reverend King for the hour, not doctor. And again, he had a doctorate in divinity studies. So this man lived for the Bible, and the Bible was the source of his inspiration. It was the source of his courage. And without the Bible, there is no Martin Luther King. And the media is not telling you that, and they don't want to tell you that, and that's why we are. And we were talking about that social justice part of Dr. King, and how not all Americans, and particularly not all Christians, see eye to eye on how best to deal with the vexing issues of poverty. But I think time has taught us a lot. And it would have been fascinating to hear and see what Dr. King would think about the trillions we've spent and the way we've spent it to help poor people. And whether it's actually helped or perhaps hurt. Because it separated the church from the giving. It sent it to a bureaucrat, and the bureaucrat gave it. I think the biggest question would be, what would King have learned from European socialism and its effect on churches throughout that continent? You know, Dennis Prager, one of the great sources of wisdom for me and one of my mentors, once said something fabulous, and he's Jewish, but we see so eye to eye on almost everything. And he said, the bigger the government, the smaller the church, and the smaller the synagogue. Would King see the folly of the great society, or, like so many modern progressives, would he double down on the commitment to bigger government and redistributionist policies? I'm not here to give you the answers. Just ask a couple of questions. Whatever your opinions on the matter, say this about Reverend King. He cared deeply for the poor. He was there. He showed up. He was in the streets fighting for the poor every day until his last. And let's talk about that last day. On April 3rd, 1968, and we're broadcasting from Oxford, Mississippi, not far from Memphis, an hour's drive. The night before his assassination, King gave a speech at the Mason Temple in Memphis, then the Church of God headquarters. He was there to support black sanitation workers who had been on strike since March 12th for higher wages and better treatment. In one incident that spurred the strike, black street repairmen received pay for 2 hours when they were sent home because of bad weather, but white employees received a full day's pay. In a speech entitled, I've Been to the Mountaintop, that night before he died, he made at least a dozen references to the Bible, and toward the end he spoke of the end of his own life as if he knew it may be ending shortly.
Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Imagine that. Like anybody, he said, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I am not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. The audience roared, as you heard. They could not know that their hero would be gunned down the very next day at the Lorraine Hotel in downtown Memphis. And though King had a sense of foreboding, he was not despondent, because he knew he was doing the Lord's work. Here were the final words of his very final public speech.
So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
You know, I'd heard Bono in an interview talk about that speech. And then he really started to dig into King's work. And out of it came, as you heard in the last hour, his greatest song, In the Name of Love, which he wrote not only for Dr. King, but it started to reconnect Bono to God, too. As a young boy growing up in Ireland, he had seen Protestants and Catholics kill each other. And he just didn't get it. And he ran away from faith. And the rest of his life, think about the music. I still haven't found what I'm looking for, The Streets with No Name. What is every single song he's writing about? God and his struggle to get back to him. So listen carefully to the stories of Martin Luther King this week, folks. Listen very carefully. The man who so loved God, who so feared God's judgment, will be stripped of that animating spirit by a fiercely secular media. But it was God and King's desire to serve him that changed this country forever. No amount of revisionist history by anybody can change that. That's what drives totalitarians crazy and secularists. They believe no God shall become before theirs, even if his name is the state. And that's what really drives liberals crazy about Jesus Christ followers. His followers believe he is the answer to their problems, not the government. As King said, Jesus lives, Jesus saves. As King said that night in Memphis a few hours before his death.
We are going on. We need all of you. You know what's beautiful to me? It's to see all of these ministers of the gospel. It's a marvelous picture. Who is it that is supposed to articulate the longings and aspirations of the people more than the preacher? Somehow the preacher must have a kind of fire shut up in his bones. And whenever injustice is around, he must tell it. Somehow the preacher must be an Amos. He said, when God speaks, who can but prophesy? Again, with Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Somehow the preacher must say with Jesus, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. And he's anointed me to deal with the problems of the poor.
Indeed. And by the way, you could substitute preacher for rabbi. And as anyone who is involved in the Jewish faith knows, the importance of a rabbi in the, not just the synagogue, but in the town, is paramount. And always the rabbi is the person you run to seek for and receive wisdom. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, the life of Martin Luther King, this day in history also brought to you by our friends at Hillsdale College. And my goodness, you want to learn about the American canon, the Western canon, everything from Plato and Aristotle to the Bible to the Founders' Vision, Locke, Montesquieu, straight up to current events. There's no better college in America to send your boy or girl. And by the way, if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale can get to you. Their online courses are the best. Their C.S. Lewis course was amazing. And of course, Economics 101, you just can't miss it. They're all available. Go to hillsdale.edu and learn more. When we come back, more on the Reverend Martin Luther King on this day in history and on the day we celebrate the life of Dr. King as a nation.
I'm pressing on.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, for the day, the life of Reverend Martin Luther King being celebrated here. And you were listening to Alicia Keys, one of the great young artists, young R&B artists, going back to her gospel roots and singing one of her favorite songs. And we play that today in honor of King. Wanted now to dig into another speech, this one a sermon, in a church in Chicago on the 17th of August, 1967. Why Jesus Called a Man a Fool. I wanted to play it because what you're going to find interesting is the audio we could find and the audio we couldn't. We searched everywhere, and there were remarkable parts of this speech that were redacted. And so you're going to hear the parts that we could find, and I'm going to read you the rest and leave it to you to think about why we couldn't find the audio on this. So let's start with the beginning of this sermon. And again, that's why we're here today, to honor Dr. King with words from him you are not hearing anywhere else in this country. Anywhere. Let's start.
I want to share with you a dramatic little story from the gospel as recorded by St. Luke. It is the story of a man who, by all standards of measurement, would be considered a highly successful man. Yet Jesus called him a fool. If you will read that parable, you will discover that the central character in the drama is a certain rich man. This man was so rich that his farm yielded tremendous crops. In fact, the crops were so great that he didn't know what to do. And it occurred to him that he had only one alternative, and that was to build some new and bigger barns so he could store all of his crops.
This recording is briefly interrupted at this point.
Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. That brother thought that was the end of life.
So he was telling the story of this rich man who thought, just eat, drink, and be merry. More. That's the end of life. A story that still resonates, don't you think? But let me now read what we couldn't find. Now, Jesus didn't call the man a fool because he made money in a dishonest fashion. There is nothing in that parable to indicate that this man was dishonest and then he made his money through conniving or exploitation. In fact, it seems to reveal that he had a medium of humanity and that he was a very industrious man. He was a thrifty man, apparently a very hard worker. So Jesus didn't call him a fool because he got his money through dishonest means. And there is nothing here to indicate that Jesus called this man a fool because he was rich. Jesus never made a universal indictment against wealth. It's true that one day a rich young ruler came to him raising some questions about eternal life, and Jesus said to him, sell all. But in that case, Jesus was prescribing individual surgery and not setting forth a universal diagnosis. Why was that cut? Again, I'll leave that to you to think about and ponder. The next clip from this speech. Take a listen.
He didn't make contributions to civil rights. He looked at suffering humanity and wasn't concerned about it.
He didn't make contributions to civil rights. He looked at suffering humanity and was concerned about it. Let me tell you the part we couldn't find. It's the part that preceded that line. Somehow in life, we must know that we must seek first the kingdom of God. And then all of those other things, clothes, houses, cars, will be added unto us. But the problem is all too many people fail to put first things first. They don't keep a sharp line of demarcation between the things of life and the ends of life. And so this man was a fool because he allowed the means by which he lived to outdistance the ends for which he lived. He was a fool because he maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. This man was a fool because he allowed his technology to outdistance his theology. This man was a fool because he allowed his mentality to outrun his morality. Somehow he became so involved in the means by which he lived that he couldn't deal with the way to eternal matters. Stripped. Couldn't find it. Again, you think about why. Let's play another part of this sermon.
Finally, this man was a fool because he failed to realize his dependence on God. Yeah. Do you know that man talked like he regulated the seasons? That man talked like he gave the rain to grapple with the fertility of the soil. That man talked like he provided the dew. He was a fool because he ended up acting like he was the creator instead of a creature. This man-centered foolishness is still alive today.
And then again, this part was redacted. In fact, he said, it has gotten to the point today that some are even saying that God is dead. The thing that bothers me about it is that they didn't give me full information because at least I would have wanted to attend God's funeral. And today I want to ask, who was the coroner that pronounced him dead? I want to raise a question. How long had he been sick? I want to know whether he'd had a heart attack or died of chronic cancer. These questions haven't been answered for me, and I am going on believing and knowing that God is alive. You see, as long as love is around, God is alive. As long as justice is around, God is alive. There are certain conceptions of God that needed to die, but not God. You see, God is the supreme noun of life. He's not an adjective. He is the supreme subject of life. He's not a verb. He's the supreme independent clause. He's not a dependent clause. Everything else is dependent on him. But he is dependent on nothing. My goodness. This is the stuff we should all be talking about every day. Christian or not. Jew or Gentile. And so as we close out this hour, I want to play a little bit. And the end of Martin Luther King's great speech to the nation and his march on Washington. So now you'll come to appreciate this very secular speech coming from this man of faith. And you'll come now to listen to it knowing from whom it came and from where it came. From God. Martin Luther King, simply a vassal, a pathway. He knew it. Now you know it.
From every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
And my goodness, it can make you cry knowing now what we know about the man, knowing now what we know about him knowing that he was more than likely not going to make it to the age of 40. And he didn't, but he still lives with us. On this day in history, and on the day that we're honoring the Reverend Martin Luther King, we were happy to bring you his own words from his own sermons and the source of everything. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.
Many try to stop me, shake me in my mind. So prove to me that he's the Lord. Show me a sign. What kind of sign they need when it all comes from within? Hey, when the loss has been found, what's to come has already been. So I tell you that I'm pressing on.